Hey, weirdos and queerdos.
Welcome to Attention Confidential, the podcast where we explore deep self-awareness, bold curiosity, and passionate advocacy for both ourselves and our communities. Hi, I'm Maggie Green. A little intro for the new folks out there. My pronouns are she, her. I am a cisgender, demisexual, panromantic woman who is also neurodivergent, a recovering marketing professional, a child abuse survivor, and an introvert with chronic anxiety.
In support of safety, please be advised that this podcast contains explicit language and direct or indirect references to material which some listeners may find triggering. Topics are highly personal and intimate, likely to touch on themes including but not limited to abuse, bigotry, body image, disability, mental health, sexuality, and trauma. Please prioritize your safety and the safety of those around you who may be exposed to this material, especially young folks. Please also note, this is an ongoing project, which means I am actively engaged in learning while creating. The format, the tools, and skills to produce this material are all new to me. As I build and refine, I ask that you understand there may be kinks along the way. Production snafus, awkward edits, background noise, and because transparency is one of my core values, I should also share that I am using software that includes enhanced features to simplify the editing and post-production process. Any editing of this content, however, this original, organic, human-generated content, is done so at my discretion, specifically to optimize sound quality, not to manipulate, omit, or alter any substantive material in the recordings.
The original music, as featured on Attention Confidential, was written, composed, and produced by Christopher Colley Biondi, a deaf pianist, composer, and dear friend in Central Kentucky who generously provided his skills and talent to support the launch of this podcast.
If it's not clear at this point, y'all, I just want to take a moment to acknowledge that this season, the podcast, and the conversations happening within this container are about so much more than a road trip. It really is a metaphor for my own life's journey and the collective journey that we are all on as humans in a really tough and challenging time. If you're listening, you know that that is true. As I think about the conversation that were recorded on the trip, it occurs to me, you know, there hasn't been a lot of acknowledgement of the trip itself, the scene and setting and the emotions as far as context kind of unfolding while these conversations are taking place. So for this episode, I thought I might reflect back a bit on some of those conversations, at least the ones you've heard so far, and give you an idea of what to expect in future episodes. By this point, we've heard from Bree, we've heard from Lenny, Tess, Eris, and Shelley. So just to kind of put that into perspective a little bit, my conversation with Bree and conversation with Lenny happened within the same 24-hour period. I left very early the morning of April 1st to head south toward Olympia, where I met a friend for breakfast to kick off the tour. Then I stopped in Portland for lunch, which is where Bree and I had our conversation. And then ultimately, my final overnight destination was in Southern Oregon to stay with Lenny and their family. I was definitely anxious. These are all people that I was really excited to connect with. And, you know, the undercurrent was, this is a really big deal. I've never taken on a project quite this size and scope and magnitude before. This is my very first time on a road trip completely alone with full autonomy and agency and resources, right, to get me through the experience. I have shared publicly in the past that I have had issues with disordered eating. So my relationship with food is a bit of a challenge. You're going to probably hear more anecdotes to support that throughout this season. And food was like a big preoccupation for me with this trip. I made sure to pack more than I needed. You know, I told myself this was an opportunity to create some new habits to improve my relationship with my body and start listening to things like hunger signals a little bit more intentionally and to challenge myself to like proactively meet those needs. Day one of the trip was like a food dream. I met a friend for breakfast that day. Had a wonderful meal with them. Brie had lunch ready for us, a homemade spread, which was really lovely. We ate and chatted. She showed me around her home. That was really cool to be able to see her in her space and interact with her cats and see all of her cool sewing machines. And then when it came to Lenny's house, this was an opportunity to be like fully immersed in the day-to-day of, you know, a family's life. If I was very much integrated into the experience as an active participant, and part of me was sort of an observer watching everything kind of happen around me. We arrived like close to the end of the workday. So Lenny and their wife were just getting home from work. The kids had just gotten home from school and it was dinner time. Like that was the note that we started on, right? Family dinner. And witnessing the dynamics of that, participating in that was really, really cool. It's been many years since I sat around a dinner table with a family, especially with children. So I was really excited and grateful to have that experience. And it evolved into family game night, which was a treat as well. It was really cool to see different communication styles across the family members and the way in which they showed up for each other and supported and encouraged one another. That is not something that I experienced very often at all as a child. And so I found that experience to be quite healing. I don't know if Lenny knows this, but they will now because I'm sharing it for the record here. But it was really special to be able to share that time and again, bear witness to the day in the life experience of a family. I didn't want to disrupt anybody's morning routine. So I got up early the next day, got everything packed and took everything to the car so that it would be an easy transition. The plan was to exit kind of en masse as Lenny and their wife were going to work and the kids were going off to school. Started heading south towards California, my next overnight stop. That's where Tess and I connected to record that episode and share a meal. My GPS automatically routes for like the most efficient path, which, you know, before I left, I knew that I wanted to spend some time on the PCH, Highway 101, but follows the coast and the Pacific Ocean. I really wanted to have that experience. And I was kind of anxious, maybe even half asleep, hadn't quite had coffee yet, trying to get going. And so I made it like 40 miles or so before I realized I'm going to be on this really boring interstate. And that is not the experience I'm looking for. So I pulled over, actually pulled up a physical map and figured out a fixed point as a new destination that would get me closer to 101. Didn't lose too much time on the road, didn't get too frustrated with myself for backtracking, and ultimately had an amazing experience traveling down the 101 into California. Tess and my original plan, we knew we were going to record a podcast episode, and we knew that we wanted to have dinner together. Tess had actually volunteered to bring dinner. We were going to do kind of like snack night, charcuterie, you know, I was picturing cheese and olives and things like that. I arrived in Crescent City about an hour before the designated meeting time and told myself, you know, even though I was starting to feel the pangs of hunger, it's only an hour. Tess is going to be here soon. We'll eat. We'll record the episode, hang out, maybe take a walk on the beach. I failed to connect with Tess ahead of time to remind them about our original plan. And so when they arrived and did not have dinner supplies in tow, I panicked a little bit. And I know they felt really bad about it and said as much. Tess, for the record, if you're listening, I'm not sharing this in any way to criticize or fault you at all. It's really about my own internal experience. And in that moment, there was that bit of panic, like, oh shit, I'm hungry. We had a plan for food. The plan did not happen. And I started feeling like those physical signs of weakness and irrationality bordering on hunger. And I remember like consciously flipping a switch in my mind, like, it's okay. You can adapt. There are alternatives, right? There's a grocery store nearby, a restaurant across the street. We could all call and order something in. So I took a deep breath, got myself situated, and approached that conversation with Tess. Like, here are our options. We ultimately decided to go to a restaurant across the street, a seafood place. It has a shellfish allergy. So that was an interesting choice. I was like thinking and worried in my mind, like, are they going to be able to find something for dinner? I was in like PJs when they arrived. So there was a physical transition that had to happen, which was challenging. I started to sweat in the midst of that panic. Like, what am I going to wear? Obviously, it doesn't matter. And like, my rational brain knows that. But in the moment, I was like, nothing feels right. Nothing looks right. I could have even gone in pajamas. It was totally a casual, like, seaside little joint and would have been fine. But anyway, the meal was lovely, and probably the best standout part of that experience, which would not have transpired had this sort of change in plans not occurred. There was a couple of platforms right there on the water, a giant jetty covered in sea lions, and they were putting on a show for the customers outside. The sun was starting to set and the temperature was starting to drop. From a sensory perspective, that was a whole thing. I had not bundled up. I was very impressed that Tess wore a beanie, and I did not had a light jacket. So there was that like sensory piece. But seeing these sea lions, interacting with them, observing them was just such an unexpected delight, especially knowing that just moments before I was sort of in this like internal panic mode as a result of the plans changing. It was just like a really beautiful sort of gift that created some balance in my mind and my heart, and it made for an excellent kind of note to start on emotionally. You know, we were in a really great, super energized, well-fed, taken care of space to launch into our conversation about body stuff and fitness thing related things. As I think about that conversation with Tess and the one with Bree and the one with Lenny, there are some recurring themes that come up for me. Of course, self-awareness is part of that. There's also the need to sort of self-advocate, identify and articulate our needs and meet those as best we can. When we can't, asking for support. As I was having that conversation with Tess, there was a visceral response. Like, the idea of connecting with my body at that point felt really overwhelming, and still does on occasion. Over the years, I have experienced periods of dissociation, which is a sort of fracturing or a disparity between my mind and my body. That has been challenging, and part of this trip, like I said, relative to food, also hydration, sensory regulation, emotional temperature regulation, all those things were coming up. You know, it was like, it felt like a calling in, like an invitation. Tess invited me to explore this further, right? The connection to my body and actually be present in it. So I made that note to myself, like, this is an opportunity. And from that moment on, it didn't happen instantly, but miles down the road, I started feeling that connection actually come to fruition, which was really powerful. I had a couple of days to myself after the conversation with Tess, after Crescent City, California. I received news and updates from a few different people. I shared in episode one about the different sort of hiccups and kinks that happened, unexpected things that inspired a change of plans. So I received the news about my grandmother breaking her foot, the news about a person in Michigan being ill, not being able to host us, my friend in West Virginia, who you'll hear from in a future episode in this season, the plumbing issue that happened. So I was receiving all this information, processing it, and also trying to figure out, what is the impact? What does that mean for the trip? And there definitely was a sense of urgency to connect with my travel companion. I wanted to make sure that they weren't aware of the possible impact on schedule, logistics, and those kinds of things. So my travel companion, Hannah, and I connected just before meeting up with Eris and Kate. Eris, obviously, you've heard from by this point in episode 5. Kate, you'll hear from, spoiler alert, this season. Hannah and I had a chance to confer and figure out how to adapt to those changes in the schedule. There was an overnight with two former clients, a parent and a child, in Minnesota. I got to spend some quality time with them and really was overwhelmed and inspired by the openness and welcoming nature of that environment, the family dynamics. Much like with Lenny's family, there was so much space and grace and support among the family members, just being themselves, right? This is a family of largely introverts, so we had that in common. They absolutely understood, fully accepted and embraced that, you know, I had just put in, I think by that point, it was like 11 hours on the road to get to their home in Minnesota. They knew I would be tired, also knew I would be keyed up, you know, and we're just really welcoming and accommodating, like at me exactly where I was, offered to support in any way. I remember specifically, like in the designated space where I was to be sleeping, my client's partner, husband, had set up a little table, not knowing what kind of mobile device I had, whether Android or iPhone, had both kinds of chargers plugged in. And it was such a small detail, but it's something that I noticed. I will always remember that. And I vocalized how much I appreciated that level of detail. I also want to acknowledge across the board what a big deal it is to host someone, invite someone perhaps that you've not spent a lot of time with in person before. Inviting them into your home is a huge deal. And I felt incredibly humbled and grateful is an understatement. I just really felt so supported. And that kindness was overwhelming. Thinking about it now, I have nothing but good feelings. Can I challenge myself to incorporate that in the future? I have always been a generous and kind person. Part of that is the perceived need to people please or avoid conflict as a result of the trauma I experienced as a child, kind of overcompensating with that. And this trip, this experience with these families and these people taught me that it doesn't have to be like that. You don't have to perform. You don't have to show up in any specific way. And if that means you're empty-handed when you arrive, that's totally fine. It wasn't about stuff. It wasn't about anything except really just being able to spend quality time together. So the person that I stayed with in Minnesota, she had made a really amazing homemade meal, including dessert, which was just outstanding and such a surprise. After we ate the long walk around her neighborhood, a long, slow walk after dark, that was no pressure, no agenda, no planned route. It was just really leisurely and amazing to not feel like I had to be in any particular place at any particular time. Of course, my stamina was quickly wearing off. I felt like a zombie a little bit. I was very tired, but also just so excited to be present in that moment. It was really special to me. By the time Hannah and I met up in central Illinois to visit Eris, I was ready to spend some time in the passenger seat and felt this emotional dam break when I saw Hannah. It was like, okay, you know, I've made it this far. This is a huge milestone. It had been several months since I saw them in person. So obviously there was excitement there. And I was so grateful because it also meant I can ease some of this pressure on myself a little bit. I have someone to share this experience with, also share the responsibility of driving, which is a lot. By that point, I put in 500 miles by myself, including a really, I mean, honestly, scary slog through Nebraska. Scary because I was tired, it was dark, and it is literally the most boring landscape I have ever seen. There is nothing for miles. It is flat as fuck, just not a whole lot going on. I was losing steam, and there were a few moments that I was not sure I was going to make it to that overnight destination. got up early the next morning, met up with Hannah, picked them up, and then ultimately headed to Eris and Kate's place, where it was incredible to meet for the first time in person these people that I had spent so much quality time online with and multiple years. Not only did we get to spend time with Eris and Kate, there were two other clients in the neighborhood that were able to join us. Again, it was very low pressure. It felt extremely supportive. There also wasn't, you know, I think about like performance and masking. I mentioned that in episode 1A as well. I didn't see that happening. And I know there is this tendency as a host to want to put our best foot forward and make sure that everything is just so. I didn't feel that way. And that doesn't mean that anything was off or weird or wrong about the space. It was just like pure authenticity, much like the dynamic with Lenny's family and my friend in Minnesota. It's just really cool to see the different relationship dynamics of a family environment. It was a stark contrast to what I experienced growing up and saw modeled for me even in early adulthood with family members and their relationships. I'm thinking about the conversation with Eris at that moment. My nerves were just completely raw, stripped of all filters, all masks, open and raw is the best way I can describe it. I had gotten a wonderful night's sleep, kind of tying this back to the friend in Minnesota, little tiny details that mattered so much to me. Hannah and I shared a bedroom at Eris and Kate's place. One of the things I thought might make me more comfortable, might make Hannah more comfortable, is having separate blankets. And I asked if there was a cotton blanket, like a thin one, that I could layer with another blanket. And I remember distinctly, Eris brought not only a thin cotton blanket to layer with, but also a fuzzy blanket that they said they debated on whether to offer it to me because it had dog hair on it. And they said, because of that, that is why they ultimately offered it to me. And I teared up in gratitude and feeling so seen and understood, because we have a fuzzy blanket just like that at home. And it wouldn't be the same if it weren't covered in dog hair. And so I think that was integral to the quality of rest that I got that night. It also speaks to the level of empathy and compassion that the people we were staying with have and operate under. I just thought that was amazing. I felt very seen and very supported. The things that Eris was sharing about identity and exploring authenticity and the expressions of that, the ways in which they had been criticized or challenged throughout life, feeling like they didn't belong, like they had to perform and people please and meet others' needs before they met their own, broke my heart wide open. I continue to go back to that episode as reminders that all of us as human beings are worthy of care and respect, of being who we are and finding the right people that make us feel seen. You know, I think a lot about authenticity, safety, and conformity came up in that conversation as well. It really left an impact on me. So I wanted to take some time kind of early on in this episode to share some of that. Again, provide some emotional context and kind of let you all know where I was, where we were as these conversations were unfolding. Which leads me to Shelley, who you've also heard from in the episode before this one. We met in Virginia, a state that I had not ever visited before, right outside the DC area. Shelley and I, we were able to share a meal, which was really lovely, before we had the conversation about stage fright and leadership, two topics that have come up a lot, not only in my professional life, but personally as well.
Attention Confidential is sponsored, produced, and distributed by Self Magnitude LLC, an ethical microbusiness on a mission to transform how you see yourself. It is hosted by Maggie Green, personal brand and style strategist for weirdos and queerdos of all ages and gender expressions, who is also the face and voice behind Self Magnitude, helping people feel seen since 2020. If you're looking for support on embodying all aspects of your identity and showing up as your radically authentic self in person, in print, and online, please visit Maggie's 100% DIY website at selfmagnitude.com.
As someone with chronic anxiety, I have had many, many, many panic attacks over the years. And for this trip, I think it is remarkable. I only had one panic attack, that it was in Salt Lake City. I have not shared the circumstances around what set it off, but I'd like to do that in this episode. As far as the mirror, something that I have really struggled with is being present. I mentioned this throughout my life, including childhood. I've had experience with periods of dissociation when my mind and body are completely different entities, not playing on the same team or working together at all. As I sit here today, I'm thinking about that difficulty of being present, how there's always a connection to the past. I know it's over. I know it's gone. And there are things that my body and my mind can't let go of that still live within me, within my cells, within my gray matter. I won't say I have a preoccupation with the past, but there certainly is awareness of it, and it is present wherever I am at any given moment. So being present in the here and now is challenging because of that. And there is this piece, I'm sure fueled by anxiety. What does the future hold? That could be what's going to happen in the next few hours, to what's on the docket for tomorrow, and also what are things going to look like 5 and 10 years down the road from now. Certainly, since starting my business, that preoccupation with the future has gotten much stronger and more intense in the entrepreneurial space, and I know that that is by design. Success is defined by revenue metrics and milestones and growth and more and better and faster and more efficient and all of that. You'll hear more about that in my conversation with Kate in a future episode. So preoccupation with the future, preoccupation with the past, and also this kind of disparity between mind and body connection. So this trip, absolutely an opportunity. I remember jotting down, right? Like, what are my goals? Big picture goals for the Tragic Optimist tour, but also like more micro personal goals. I thought, I really want to see what it might be like to relax. Can I experience that sensation physically, mentally, and challenging myself to be present? So pulling myself away from moments where I'm thinking and sort of living or being embodied by the past and those experiences, and likewise with the future. Am I safe? Am I hungry? Am I hot? What do I need right now? Where am I now? Observing things around me. I'm thinking about that walk in Minnesota after dinner. Like, it wasn't about anything else except just being there and sharing that space on that time with that person in that place, in that moment. And so I won't say that the trip has me having that fully figured out yet. It's still a challenge. I also acknowledge the trip was its own kind of container inside of that 30-day period, inside the vehicle, inside these different spaces. And since returning, I am still actively practicing being present. In this moment, as I sit here today, I am feeling anxious about the future, for a lot of different reasons. So trying to pull myself away from that fear in this moment, I am safe. I have what I need. My basic needs are met. I've talked a bit about ADHD and anxiety as far as self-awareness goes. When I was originally diagnosed at 3 or 4 years old, at the time they diagnosed me with ADD. There was no outward sign of hyperactivity. Of course, now everything as far as attention or inattention goes kind of falls under that greater ADHD umbrella. And there's been a lot of learning and more data shared about the way in which hyperactivity can present internally. So there is always a tension inside of me, a buzzing of some kind. So I said, you know, part of my hope, my goals, personal goals for this journey was to connect with the concept of relaxation physically and mentally. That is different from being asleep or unconscious or intoxicated. Relaxation is a conscious activity, and I did not really experience that on the trip. And also have not ever really experienced it in my life. But I now know that part of that is the way in which my brain is wired. It's shaped differently. It holds and processes information, sensory data differently. And so I'm coming to a place of acceptance with that. And I think the more acceptance I can have, the more I am exposed to others and interact with others who have that level of acceptance about themselves and others, empathy and compassion helps me to strengthen that acceptance within myself. I think the deeper I dive into that, perhaps one day, I don't feel it right now, but perhaps one day I will experience what it feels like to relax. Very curious for those of you who are listening, I would love to know, what does relaxation mean to you? What does that feel like? How does it feel internally in your body, in your mind? What do the circumstances around you look like in that situation? I really want to know, because it is an absolute mystery to me, something that is kind of a code that I aim to crack while I'm still on this earth. And I want to learn as much as I can about it. I know about meditation and yoga and all of these different activities. The closest I can say, perhaps, to experiencing feelings of relaxation through an activity is like a bubble bath. But honestly, y'all, I cannot physically allow myself to be in a bubble bath trying to relax for more than like 20 minutes at a time. I'm like, this is overwhelming. I'm not relaxing. I'm worrying about the next thing, or I remembered something I forgot. Anything that you can share about your experience with relaxation, I would love to hear it. Maybe there are others of you out there who had similar experiences, or maybe chasing this idea or trying to crack this code of relaxation and calm. I'd love to know if that is true for you. What has your experience with it been like so far? For the magnifying glass segment, I thought I might talk a little bit about emotional bandwidth, which certainly lends itself to an opportunity to share about the panic attack that I have on the road. I identify as an empath. Certainly, if I am exposed to or around any kind of emotions, but particularly like intense, emotionally activated moments and energies in spaces and with people, I feel very much like a sponge that impacts me on a physical and emotional level. If someone is angry or they're getting angry, I can feel it in the air. I can feel it in my body. I take that on, right? I, in a way, embody that feeling. The same is true for joy or excitement. If someone is sharing about a special interest or a project that they're excited about or something that they're looking forward to, I am absolutely right there, keyed up alongside with them. Like, yes, yes, yes. It makes me a great cheerleader for people. It also helps me show up to help hold others accountable to their goals. Like, remember that feeling. Remember what your goals are. Remember you are worthy. Remember that cool sensation that happened in your body and your heart when you were talking about this thing or thinking about it or working on it. That makes it really challenging as far as bandwidth is concerned, because I have my own feelings and thoughts about things. And then there is what is going on outside of me. I've also shared that I'm an introvert, and so packing in a lot of social time and peopling, that kind of interaction, being in the same space with others and all of their emotions, especially on this trip, was challenging in a way that I can't possibly describe. It was concentrated into a very short amount of time. My body and brain had no space to recover from those experiences. There were some unpleasant mental and physical consequences internally, just because I was like tapped out. but also I could not get enough. And I would do it over again in a heartbeat. Absolutely no regrets, only gratitude for what I experienced. And it was hard. It was work, right? To regulate my own emotions, to show up and be able to navigate others' emotional experiences following the trip. It was probably 3 or 4 weeks out. I completely dropped, like full on major depressive episode. Partly, I'm sure, inspired by grief that the experience was over and my body and my brain caught up to the fact that I had just had this intense experience. I had a chance to kind of take a breath and reset. And that awareness that it was over, the awareness of the intensity of it, and the physical, emotional, and mental impact that it had on me sent me into a really dark place. And I think part of that too was my body saying, you need to fucking rest. You need to slow down. And it lasted a couple of weeks. I have been in and out of depression since then for much of the same reasons. When I think about the trip, I have only good emotions. And the intensity of that is really hard because, you know, it's in the past. It's not here now. And it may or may not happen to that level in the future. I don't know. So as far as emotional bandwidth, I have way more capacity than I thought I did. And there are some pretty distinct thresholds, right? I recognize as a result of this experience, my tendency to push that threshold, to push my own limits, to test the confines of those bounds and parameters my body and mind have created to help me feel safe or healthy, functional. My first panic attack that I remember and had the language to describe that experience was around age 12 or 13. My caretaker at the time had been medicated and treated for depression and anxiety. And I remember her providing medical intervention for my first Xanax. When I think about my experiences with self-medication and just pharmaceutical therapy in general, there are a couple of times when I experienced what I hear people describe as relaxation. The first time I took Valium, for example, like quiet in my brain for the first time in my life, I had never experienced that before. Is that what relaxation feels like? Maybe you can tell me. So yeah, I definitely had issues with panic attacks. The physical symptoms, if you've never experienced anxiety or panic attack, for me, there's a lot of temperature regulation issues. I feel a strong heat over my body, like an oppressive heat, sweating not only in like the hot spots, like my armpit and groin, but my hands start really shallow breathing to the point where I have hyperventilated. A lot of people describe a sensation of having a weight on your chest, like someone is sitting on your chest. There's a skin crawling kind of sensation as well, where I feel like I just want to crawl out of my skin or like peel my body off and be able to breathe, get some fresh air. I've experienced shaking in my voice, but also in my limbs. I have worked with my medical provider to address the physical symptoms of anxiety. I'm thinking about the conversation with Shelley and stage fright. The medication that I'm on right now that I don't use every day, it's only when I know I have big anxious things coming up, is a beta blocker. So there's no like psychotropic effects. It addresses specifically the physical symptoms. It almost acts like an antihistamine. Sometimes it is prescribed in that same way, but what it is typically prescribed for is performance anxiety. And when I take that medication, I still have the internal anxious experience, the racing thoughts, the fear and panicky thoughts and feelings, but the physical symptoms like the shaking and the sweating, the shallow breathing and increased heart rate are gone, which gives me the space and the chance to work through the internal experience and still function in whatever capacity I need to in that physical environment, whether, say, giving a speech or delivering a workshop or something like that. Even driving sometimes can be triggering for me. And so because there are no psychotropic effects, it's not an issue to take a beta blocker before I know I'll be operating a motor vehicle. That can be really, really helpful. So kind of talking around this, there is a little bit of embarrassment because it feels so small, but it was such a big deal to me in the moment. I've been talking around the one panic attack I had on the Tragic Optimist tour in Salt Lake City. I had never been to Utah before. There was an awareness of my family's history with the Mormon religion, which for purposes of this podcast, I'm going to call it what it is. It's a fucking cult. If, you know, thinking through all of that and the meaning of that for me to kind of connect with that place and explore those things emotionally, that was a big deal. So for context, that was happening inside of my brain and in my heart. Physically and geographically, I had been dodging spring storms. I was also racing sunsets because I have a really hard time seeing at night. And if it's dark and raining, it actually becomes a risk to my physical safety. And so with every overnight destination, but particularly Salt Lake City, because that was one of the stops where I was totally alone, just really pushing to try to get to where I needed to go before it rained and before it got dark, or both. So highly keyed up. Lots of different like possible triggers and factors happening around me and inside of my body. On top of that, like I said, there's all these different updates. There was the anxiety and urgency about connecting with my travel companion to sort of download all things that would impact our schedule. So I had that bit going on as well. I have the friend in Michigan texting to try to coordinate a phone call so that they can let me know what's what. They're like, once you get settled in Salt Lake City, give me a call. By the time I arrived at the bed and breakfast, it had started to rain. It was almost completely dark. I had not had a full meal that day, so I was definitely bordering on hanger, if not fully past that threshold. I'll start by saying my room, my lodging, was a third floor accommodation, which meant that I had to carry my things from the vehicle up multiple flights of stairs. The place itself was temperature regulated for the average human who is not anxious and not already stressed and sweating. By the time I got all my shit upstairs, I was soaked completely through my clothes with sweat. I am a fat person. It felt good in a way that I was like strong enough to navigate that. It really was hard at the same time. I was sweaty. I was out of breath. I'm like, okay, I'm going to try to get it up here in as few trips as possible. Got everything up there. I'm like, all right, I'm going to take a breath now, figure out what I'm going to eat. I'm going to bathe and I'm going to like settle in for the night. I'll call my friend in Michigan after dinner. We'll catch up and figure that out. I'll get a good night's rest and be back on the road. That is not what happened at all. I got into the room, got all my stuff, sat down, and I scope everything out so I knew what to expect. Part of that was discovering that the private bathroom was actually in a separate space, which meant that I would have to walk into a public space and then into the private bathroom. So that was another kind of trigger. I'm dealing with that. I'm thinking about privacy. That is something that is really important to me, to be able to get close to something like relaxation and settling in for the night. So I go to draw the blinds. There are two windows in the space. I drew the blinds on the one window. No problem. Come over to the other window and the blinds will not come down. I tried 100 different times to the side, pulling it out and down below, like kept trying and trying and could not get the shade to come down on the window. The window is situated to the right of the bed and perpendicular to that is this small pedestal sink where, let's say, you might wash your makeup off or brush your teeth. Lovely. I'm like, I can't get comfortable. I can't stand here and disrobe knowing that this window is open. I just could not do it. All of those factors culminated into full-on panic attack. Not only am I covered in sweat, I'm sweating more because the panic is further setting in and I start sobbing uncontrollably, which is when the panic attack dam breaks. That is like point of no return. I am fully in it. Cannot articulate my needs. Cannot function. Reached out to the innkeeper as best I could, describe the situation in text message. I was like, I have tried. It's not working. This is not conducive to you know, a relaxing night. I'm not going to be able to settle in until this is addressed. Thankfully, they lived nearby and were close enough that they could come and help. But even reaching out to them and navigating that interaction was just really, really difficult, especially in the midst of a panic attack. So I was like, okay, I'm hot. This is a third floor. Heat rises. It's only getting worse. I need air. I need cool. So I went outside. It's pouring down rain at this point, but that's okay because cool water coming from an open sky is probably exactly what I need at that moment, right? One of my coping strategies for panic attacks is cold. You know, put ice on the back of my neck or a cold washcloth or something like that. Cold water. I got to my car and I thought, I'm going to call my partner. Maybe he can help me figure out what food options are around so that I can take this decision off of my plate. Got the innkeeper on the window situation. So I'm slowly, you know, one at a time kind of reducing the cognitive and emotional load. I'm still just crying, sobbing, borderline hyperventilating, definitely shallow breaths. So I'm doing a little bit of breath work, reminding myself to drink water. It's going to be okay. I'm safe. I have snacks in the vehicle that can get me by. Even though I was not in a place to really make a rational decision, I got a little snack. It's like, okay, I'm going to talk this out. I'm sharing with my partner what's happening. He's like, it's all right. I got you. What do you need? He helped me identify a place for food that sounded good. I'll get it delivered. Not in a position to go somewhere, certainly. So I'll have them come to me. And unfortunately, before the food arrived, after the innkeeper got the window thing situated, got off the phone with my partner, placed the order for food, I decided to call my friend in Michigan instead of prioritizing my own physical and mental needs in that moment. By the time the food arrived, an hour later, I was in a really physically and emotionally vulnerable space. I enjoyed the meal. It was probably the most delicious, like, Mediterranean-style takeout I have ever had. I was definitely feeling vulnerable, stressed about the changes in the schedule. It was probably midnight before I finally sort of settled down and told myself, all right, I'm going to take a bath. That is definitely in my toolkit for helping ease anxiety. And it was challenging because I got to go out into a public space before I can reach the bathroom. It's also late at night. The facility is like eerily quiet. All of the other guests were already asleep. So I was like kind of worried and self-conscious, maybe even paranoid about causing further disruption. I already felt like an asshole for having to call the innkeeper to help with the shades on the window. I'm gonna have to message her again and just to check in to reassure myself, like, is it gonna be an issue for me to take a bath this late at night? She's like, absolutely not. Make yourself at home. And that was all the reassurance I needed, even though I was still very conscious about it and tiptoeing around. Got me to a place where I was able to take a bath, settle in, and get to the point where I felt like I could fall asleep. But in that moment, it was absolutely the worst feeling. I tried to take a video of the issue with the shade on the window, and I tried to send that to the innkeeper, and it didn't work. There was like that frustration as well. It's like, I don't know how to explain. I just need it fixed, you know? It was very intense. I kept kind of replaying it in my brain, but I was super grateful to finally get to a place where I could settle in. And I told myself too, like, I'm going to take a beta blocker tonight. I almost never do that before bed. But I was afraid if I didn't, that I might not be able to physically relax enough to actually sleep. And I told myself too, proactively the next day, knowing that I would have to drag all my shit downstairs and it would be, you know, a possible repeat of the night before, like, I'm going to take that beta blocker proactively. I'm going to put myself in a better physical sort of homeostatic space to be able to tackle whatever comes next, right? But yeah, that was the only panic attack I had. It was extremely intense and it was triggered by something on the surface. It was very small. Couldn't get the window shade to come down on the window. But as you all know now, there was all this other context, all of these other factors and triggering things happening, contributing to that. I appreciate the safe space to share here. Also, in the spirit of the magnifying glass, I thought I might share a few of the strategies and tools and coping skills that I use to address panic attacks and feelings of anxiety in addition to, and sometimes in the absence of, my trusty Theta Blocker as a resource as far back as adolescence. One of the things that generally always brings me out of that highly activated, intense, fearful, anxious headspace is the act of brushing my hair, specifically someone else brushing my hair. Before being introduced to Xanax, that's something that I had requested of my mom in several instances, and other caretakers too, when I was experiencing that panicky feeling, can you brush my hair? That's a little bit complicated now. My hair has changed both in texture, length, and volume over the years. Brushing my hair and hair care and maintenance is very challenging these days, and I don't necessarily trust others to do that, particularly on the heels of depression. Sometimes it's a whole ass process to detangle the knots and all of that, but when my hair is in a state of good maintenance and care, brushing my hair is always something that seems to work well. Scalp massages and sort of head stroking fits into that same category that somatic and physical sensation often helps to counteract those feelings internally. I mentioned cold, so cold air, cold water, a cold washcloth, but also ice. I have definitely resorted to, you know, literally getting a few cubes of ice and putting them on the back of my neck or on my forehead, face, ears, behind the ears, neck area in the front across my breastplate, but also in the back of my neck. Those spaces coming in contact with cold can help sort of bring me back to the moment. You know, in the wintertime is like the best time. If I'm having that experience while inside my home, I can always go outside, and that wall of cold air, sometimes even just cracking a window, being able to put my face next to it and take in that cold air, can be really, really helpful. I also mentioned breath work. I'm still working through that, still trying to figure out what strategies work best for me in collaboration with my therapist and exploring suggestions and resources and insights from others. That's all I've got. Anxiety obviously is a perpetual challenge for me. It's something that I navigate on a daily basis. And not feeling it so much in this moment, to kind of tie it back to being present. Of course, I've been talking for a while at this point in this episode, and sometimes doing exactly that, verbalizing emotions, verbalizing physical experiences, talking through things is a way to process and help me navigate. You know, I mentioned I had called my partner in the midst of that panic attack in Salt Lake City. Being able to lean on someone in those moments, I just need to be heard. I need to say this out loud. Hearing myself say the thing helps me acknowledge and identify what is real and true and what is not. Even though anxiety is a very irrational experience and I catch my brain telling me outright lies in those moments, having that support to connect with someone is always really, really helpful. And yeah, all of those things in combination with one another, in isolation from each other, depending on the context, can be really helpful. And none of it is a cure. Right. This is something that I will always be navigating. Ensuring planning for emotional bandwidth is a daily challenge too. That's something that I need to always prioritize. And no matter what activities I'm engaged in professionally or personally, I've got to do it. I feel lucky and fortunate to like know these things about myself and be able to put them into words. If you've had your own experiences with this, I would love to know. It's always helpful to know that I'm not alone. And sometimes I need that reminder, especially when I'm experiencing anxiety. So for the final segment today, the megaphone, what feels close to my heart as I'm thinking about my own life's journey, as well as our collective navigation of life on this planet, in this country, what might I say? What do I want to talk about or share with you all in terms of like actionable insights? The thing that I keep coming back to in this moment is relationships are two-way streets. You know, there's an analogy there, right? The Tragic Optimist tour was a road trip. So the two-way street reference is definitely intentional there. But certainly it goes beyond these contexts, these emotions and conversations and people. Relationships are two-way streets. I didn't always know that, or perhaps I knew that, but didn't know what that looked like. I was exposed to a lot of one-way interaction and transactional approaches to relationships. Many of the people who were responsible for my care treated others like commodities or products, resources for their own gain. I work really hard to give more than I take, and a consequence of that is really not being effective in the taking piece. So I participated in one-way interactions, which I won't call relationships, because again, relationships are two-way, have been part of one-way dynamics in which my primary role, or at least my perception of my role in the quote-unquote relationship, was to be an audience or a receptacle for information or a dedicated support the other parties were taking and taking and taking. I didn't feel comfortable taking up space or creating space or sharing my needs, because again, my perception was that my role was a caretaker or caregiver. In some situations, it was like a parentified type of role, including with my own parents, with my sibling, with other people in my life, where I realized that it was unhealthy and also unsustainable. I'm thinking about friends and family, and I'm thinking about the business as well. You know, I'm not a martyr, and neither are you. If you're listening to this and this is resonating with you, if you've had experiences with one-way interactions and are not feeling fully supported, or you're in quote-unquote relationships where you don't feel like there's room for you to exist or be yourself or share your feelings and thoughts and joys and challenges, I want you to remember that you're not a martyr, that you deserve to have relationships that are meaningful, mutually supportive, that serve you as much as you're able to serve the relationship, the other parties involved. You are worthy of care. You're worthy of respect, consideration, compassion, empathy, kindness, without having to earn them. I feel like respect is the outlier there. Respect and trust as well are both things that are earned. And I say that knowing that I give those things freely until I cannot. If that respect is compromised or the trust is broken, I know enough about myself, about relationships, about what is sustainable and what is not, that once I've lost respect for someone, or once trust has been broken, there's a wound there that requires repair. And we as autonomous adults and humans have the choice to continue investing time and energy and love and care into relationships that do or do not serve us. That is a choice. I also recognize how difficult that can be on an internal level, and that sometimes maybe you don't feel like you have a choice, but you know, your only value is that which you can give to others. I'm thinking about the conversation with Eris, where they discovered they don't owe anybody shit. Neither do you, and neither do I. When it comes to clients and my business, it's been like a whole new set of learning and experiences where perhaps I devalued or undervalued myself, or gave more than I ought to have, or that was in alignment with my values and what I knew to be true about myself, my business, what I want for the future. I absolutely hate that I can't do this work and not also worry about compensation. But that is mission critical, right? It's a business. I absolutely have to provide a living wage for myself. This is my livelihood. There are a lot of people out there who want my help, who have enlisted my support,
who have gotten things or taken things from me and have absolutely zero intention of ever compensating me for that value. That's a tough pill to swallow in and of itself. And I understand there are plenty of people out there, maybe many of you listeners, who are feeling the economic pinch and can't set something aside or budget for something like a personalized service like what I provide. As I continue doing this work, more and more, going back to episode 1B, you know, my relationship with money, I'm trying really hard to work through those wounds and heal the trauma around my relationship to money. And also, capitalism fucking sucks. And you are where we are. What's the alternative? I have done a lot of different value exchange and bartering type of engagements where the other party has something that I want or need, and the same is true in reverse. And we provide equitable value, whatever we both think is fair and agree to. That is not sustainable for paying my bills. I'm hurting right now financially. I absolutely cannot afford to do anything for free at this point. And I've been working through the implications of that. Also, why do I feel like I have to do things for free? Why is it so hard for me to say, I am worthy, I am valuable, and this is what I charge, full stop? It's getting easier. I think it might always be a little bit of a challenge because of my history, my experience around those things, including relationships and transactions. What do I really want to say to you? What is actionable? If you have experience like I do, or a history with codependence, which is very typical in families that have addiction, substance abuse issues, mental illness, poverty, the intersection of all of those things, scarcity. Codependence is a risk factor, right? It's taken a long time, like my entire adult life, untangle all that was wrapped up in this idea of codependence, the people pleasing, the peacemaking, the martyrdom. All of those things have happened in part as a result of growing up in a culture of codependence. And I've shared about this before. Interdependence is a thing. I only recently discovered that language just in the last 5 years since I've started this business. What does that mean? It means, and it honors, that we are all autonomous individuals as humans. And it acknowledges, too, that we need to be able to rely on one another. We need to lead our own lives, and we need the shared experience for the full spectrum of humanness. That is the healthiest path. That's what we're working toward. I've also shared before tendencies coming from codependence to kind of like overcorrect or overcompensate with hyper independence. And that ties back to it being difficult for me to take up space, make my needs known, ask for help. It's still sometimes a challenge, especially if I'm in a vulnerable emotional state, to be able to say, this is not sustainable. I need more, or I need different. It's not easy, but it is absolutely necessary for our well-being, for longevity and stamina to even be able to function and hack it in this thing called life. So I mentioned being open to receive. That's definitely something that I've learned from the Tragic Optimist Tour, not only asking for help and support, but letting myself have that without feelings of guilt or shame or questioning the other person's motivations, to really just be open to that. I'm thinking about mutual support as well. Bearing witness is absolutely a kindness, a service, a way to support with everything that is happening around us in this country, in the world. Whatever your capacity is as far as emotional bandwidth, or physical or financial bandwidth, if you don't have financial resources, if you don't have the ability to provide a service, showing up and being there for someone who needs support, that bearing witness, doesn't even have to be someone that you know, although that is really important and valuable too. And your immediate interpersonal relationships, creating that space for others, listening to them without judgment, without rushing to try to provide a solution, carving out that space, taking in information about others' experiences. I understand we have to pace ourselves. There's another kind of key takeaway too. Pace yourself. right? Don't overdo it. We hear, you know, the phrase, you can't give from an empty cup. That's absolutely true. You're going to hear in a future episode in this season, you know, priority number one is you've got to make sure that you are taken care of first before you can take care of others. That is true. I'll tell you now, and that message will be reinforced later in this season. But I really want to emphasize bearing witness, showing up, taking information in, creating space for others without judgment, without criticism, without jumping to providing a solution. Bearing witness is absolutely part of service. It is part of that two-way dynamic of a relationship. And maybe in that moment, there's not the other side of that. Maybe bearing witness means you give this time and space to this person or this relationship, this topic, this story, whatever it is, bearing witness now for that to come back to you and be mutually valuable and engaging to you later on. Not doing it for your personal, for your own personal gain, doing it because you know that it's the right thing to do and knowing that when you need that, either that person or someone else will be there for you when you need it, and being open to receive that, I think, is really powerful. So again, just to tie it all back together, relationships are two-way streets. It's not a one-way, not a roundabout. And if you find that you are giving more than you are receiving, I think that is worth examining. If you feel likewise on the other end of that spectrum, maybe you're not aware of this, but maybe hopefully the other party or parties will call this to your attention. Hey, I don't feel like there's a lot of room for me, or I need a little bit more. It feels like you're taking a lot, and I'm happy to give it. And also, I need support from you. Be open to that. Be open to looking at that about yourself and taking whatever actions to not only examine it, but to take action accordingly. You're worth it. The people in your life are worth it. We're all worth it. Don't forget that.
That's all for this episode of Attention Confidential, but of course the conversation doesn't end here. I encourage you to keep exploring, keep questioning, and most of all, keep sharing your stories. If today's conversation spoke to you, please pass it on. And if you have a story of your own you'd like to showcase, I am here and ready to listen. You can find all past and future episodes at selfmagnitude.com/podcast. And until next time, remember this. Your voice matters.